This is Keeping the Faith, a weekly discussion about issues of faith, spirituality, religion, and ethics. Now here's your host, Steve Shoemaker.
Good afternoon. This is Keeping the Faith. My name is Don Nolan. I'm subbing for Steve today. Steve is probably in Israel as we speak. He will be back next weekend for a regular scheduled program of Keeping the Faith. Tonight, or this afternoon, our program focuses on the work of an organization entitled the Final Exit Network. And we have here with us in the studio two individuals who are involved in a local affiliate, a local group of the Final Exit Network. And this organization is connected with a variety of activities associated with the work of Derek Humphreys, who, if some of you have read his book from many years ago, Final Exit. The topic is multifaceted, and so instead of me trying to introduce it, let's just turn directly to our guests. Our guests are Laura Wetzel, who has in the past been a counselor and family educator here locally, and she is involved in this local affiliate. And we also have Professor Bob Jones, retired from the Department of Religious Studies at the University of Illinois. Welcome, Bob and Laura.
Thank you.
Thank you for joining us. First of all, let's let the audience know that this is a call-in program, and you're welcome to call our local number, 333-9455, or 800-222-9455. If you have any questions for our guests this afternoon, we'll be glad to take your call. Why don't we start off with just a general introduction to the Final Exit Network and your local group, and then let's talk a little bit about how you all got involved. Laura?
Well, originally it was called the Hemlock Society, and then they changed the name to Compassion and Choices, and they seem to be backpedaling. So this group, the Final Exit Network, split off from that.
How many years ago? How long has the Hemlock Society been around locally?
Well, to my knowledge, there has not been.
Oh, not locally.
It's not local affiliate. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
But the Hemlock Society nationally has been on around two or three decades, yes?
Oh, yes, easily.
I think so, yeah.
And Bob, you got involved recently. How long have you been involved in the local affiliate group?
Actually, I've been a member of the Hemlock Society for 20-odd years, I think, by now. But there is, I think, no local affiliate of Compassions and Choices. I think there's one in some other part of Illinois. I got involved because I think Laura had the mailing address for the Compassion and
right.
Choices groups, and so I knew nothing about Final Exit until I got your email.
Huh.
And I'm actually still a member of Compassion and Choices as well as being a part of the Final Exit group now.
What is the Final Exit Network? I'm going to pull your microphone just a little closer. Laura?
It is an organization. I guess I could read our goals as to serve people who are suffering intolerably from an incurable condition, which has become more than they can bear, to sponsor research to find out new, peaceful, and reliable ways for self-deliverance, to provide the use of advanced directives, that's like living wills, durable powers of attorney, and so forth for health care, and to educate and advocate for individuals when their advanced directives are not being honored.
And how did you get involved? What was your interest in this, personally?
My mother died an incredibly long, protracted death. It was really horrible. She lost both bowel and bladder control. She lost pretty much her mental functioning. She had no teeth. So there she lay in her own excrement, not even knowing what it was. So she would get her hands in it and smear it and have it caked under her fingernails. It was really, really awful. And this went on for years. I'm not talking weeks or months. I'm talking years that she lay in this condition. She had no teeth, so she couldn't eat food. They tried to feed her baby food, and she would slap it away. Eventually, she got so she would cry out periodically, and they put her in what they called the screamer's ward. And when she deteriorated, lost so much weight, curled into a fetal position, they put IVs in her arm and tried to feed her that way. She would jerk them out, which let me know she did not want to live. But at that time, there was no living will, and in fact, it would not have helped if there had been, because she was not on life support. So it was just a horrible, gruesome, incredibly drawn-out mm-hmm. death.
She was sort of in between terminally ill and chronically.
That's right. She had no diagnosis of mm-hmm. terminal illness. She had several strokes, and she might have had Parkinson's, but it was just a diagnosis of elimination at that time.
And how did this affect your thinking about end-of-life issues?
I was horrified. And I spend my life really living in horror of that happening to me. And I know some people hate to bring financial matters into it, but I'm sure my financial resources would be used up completely, and then it would be tax dollars keeping me alive in that condition. I absolutely do not want that for myself. And I think the money could much better be spent other ways, like helping children, for example.
And Bob, how did you come to this personally?
I have to go back a bit further, and I think the story that I would tell isn't nearly as horrific as the one that Laura has. But when I was a child growing up, from the time that I was about 7 years old until I was 15, my father was ill, more or less continuously. He discovered he had a malignant melanoma when I was very young, and it had metastasized. And so the last 7 or 8 years of his life, he was in and out of the hospital with various kinds of cancer. And then finally, when I was 15 years old, he died of a brain tumor. So at a fairly crucial point in my growing up, death was sort of constantly present but not spoken about. I think I acquired a sense that in the presence of extreme illness and the possibility of death, all other questions tend to seem very trivial and shallow by comparison. And the two things that I remember most that I think are relevant to being involved with the Hemlock Society or Final Exit are, first of all, my father was he wasn't well off by any means, but he was an extremely dignified person. He had a presence, at least in the eyes of a young boy, he did, I think his illness was constantly threatening to embarrass or humiliate him or us in some way. And maintaining his sense of self-respect and dignity was a considerable motivation for our family through that time. The second thing is that when he finally did become pretty obviously terminally ill, there wasn't going to be a recovery from this, or if there was, it was going to be an extremely long rehabilitation with the likely reoccurrence of the cancer metastasizing and so on. All of these decisions that had to be made with end-of-life care, including the decision of whether or not to have radical brain surgery and so on, fell on my mother. And I was old enough by that time, I was 15, to talk to my mother and listen to her agonize over these decisions that she had to make. And I'm sure that that was a process that I unconsciously stored away as one that I didn't want to have to repeat for someone that I loved, or to have anyone that I loved have to repeat that process for me. So death was a presence, as I say, something on my mind early, and then remained so, as it turned out. So.
Now, if final exit at the local group or its services were available to you, Laura, back when your mother passed and your father, Bob, what benefits would they offer to you?
I think one of the main things we've learned is the importance of talking to friends and family about your wishes. And so many people put this off. They don't want to talk about it. Sometimes the elder person will try to get the younger people to talk about it, and they don't want to hear about it. But it must be talked about. And I had no idea, really, there were so many decisions that needed to be made. Mm-hmm. We learned about that in two of our meetings, one, the legal issues, where we had an attorney speak to us, and also in the other meeting where we had a hospice worker talk to us. There are so many things that our friends and family need to know about our wishes. And I guess to get back to your question, our mother didn't talk about those things, and we really didn't know what she wanted, although I did strongly suspect when she jerked the IVs out of her arm and refused to eat and so forth, I was pretty sure that she did not want to live. Mm-hmm. But I didn't have the courage to surface the issue, and apparently neither did she, and then eventually she was not really able to.
Mm-hmm. How would final exit have assisted you back when your father passed?
I think in the ways that Laura's just described. I mean, the interesting thing is that, first of all, there's an enormous amount of information that you need. And it's not information that's easily obtained privately or individually. It's information that's best acquired in the context of a community. And
It's not part of the process of being an adult, right?
Exactly. It's not the sort of thing you learn, like, you know, getting a driver's license or holding a job or discharging some specialized function that you might have. I mean, there are things that really require a lot of thought and a lot of conversation and a lot of sharing of experience. And I have to say, one of the revelations to me since being involved in Final Exit and having attended some of these meetings and read some of the literature is things that I thought that I knew, having thought about these things before, I thought, and had reached a relatively stable decision about what I wanted done and so on. It turned out to need some rethinking as time goes on. We did have a meeting with a lawyer to discuss legal aspects. We had a meeting with a hospice worker who discussed hospice. And then just 2 weeks ago, we had a meeting where we talked about the five wishes document, which I hope we'll have time to talk about today. Mm-hmm. And in fact, my wife and I just spent a couple of days filling out our own five wishes documents. And again, I mean, we were both surprised at how difficult it was to answer some of these questions, despite the fact that both of us had thought about this for quite a while and thought we knew what we felt and thought about these things. So it's If this kind of information, and particularly if this kind of community support had been available for my mother, let's say, as my father was quite obviously deteriorating, I think it would have been enormously helpful to her. And if before he sank into a coma, he had been able to fill out a document like the Five Wishes, which includes both a living will and a durable power of attorney for health care. If he had been able to do that, it would have been much easier for my mother because those decisions would have been spelled out. He would have indicated in the document how he wanted to be treated during his last days and so on. Since nothing like that was available, these things became very difficult.
Let's do talk about the Five Wishes in just a few minutes. Let me just indicate here that this is a call-in show, and if you have any questions about the Final Exit Network or the local affiliate for Laura Wetzel or Bob Jones, our guest this afternoon, please call in at 333-9455. We also have an 800 number, 1-800-222-9455. Notice in your by the way, there is a website if anybody's interested in visiting the National Final Exit Network. It's www.finalexitnetwork.org. And there is a passage in here in which you say there are many people who are undergoing great stress and grief and struggling with end-of-life issues, and you indicate, or the national organization indicates, that the Final Exit Network is an all-volunteer organization dedicated to serving people who are suffering from an intolerable condition. Network volunteers offer you counseling, support, and even guidance to self-deliverance at a time and place of your choosing, but you always do the choosing. We will never encourage you to hasten your death. I gather that this is part of the work that you do.
Yes.
This description.
Well, maybe I should jump in and say,
I thought you might want to clarify.
In order to, there is a final exit guide program. However, in order to be a final exit guide, you have to go to special training, and they hold that in Chicago and other larger cities maybe once or twice a year. And none of our local people have attended that.
Mm-hmm.
So we would not be qualified to do that at this point in time.
Are you hoping to expand in that direction, or?
I'm not.
No, I don't mean you personally. I mean the organization.
The group, yes. Mm-hmm. We're hoping that some of our members would avail themselves of that.
When did the local affiliate start? Is it?
I started it in December, actually, just mm-hmm. a very brief organizational meeting. And then in January, we viewed the Final Exit DVD with Derek Humphrey, which is actually a step-by-step guide to self-deliverance. And at that point, I almost chickened out, but we do look for, the network does look for ways to, you know, safe, painless, easy methods of self-deliverance.
Mm-hmm. We have a caller on line one. Hello, you're on Keeping the Faith. What's your question?
I had a question on how this affects both life insurance and your medical insurance. Is a way to make your final exit something that is coverable by your health insurance? And also, does this negate any of your life insurance policy? Thank you.
Thank you for your question.
I have no idea. It's a good question. I had never thought of that. I think health insurance, it shouldn't make a difference. But,
I understand that life insurance policies typically, I don't know that much about them, but typically have suicide clauses. Is that right?
I have heard of that, yeah. Mm-hmm.
So that hasn't been discussed?
It has not come up in our group. Actually, mm-hmm. I know of a case many years ago where there was a suicide and there was a big investigation.
Mm-hmm.
But that was many years ago, so probably I really don't know what the current mm-hmm. status would be.
Before we talk about the Five Wishes, Bob, you're a professor of religious studies for many years. Is there a tradition within the world's religions or your particular tradition that supports moving in this direction?
I have to say that you're talking to a functional pagan. of course, most of the world's religions either explicitly or implicitly prohibit the taking of one's own life. But again, we're not talking here just about self-deliverance, as this document describes. And one of the important things that the group does is provide information and support for a wide variety of end-of-life issues. I mean, there are different gradations, different degrees, and so on, short of suicide or self-deliverance that are important here.
And your interest in this organization, at least temporarily, is filling the gap for support, not necessarily the big guerrilla question of self-deliverance or suicide.
Right, although it's I think, very wise to learn about those things as well. You don't know where you're going to be or what your situation is going to be at any point down the road. Mm-hmm. And to me, it's always been bizarre that so much of the question of the awareness of end-of-life issues is hidden or suppressed or privatized in this society. I've always thought that the American, particularly conception of death, is very strange in some ways. And of course, it's been paradised endlessly as a consequence.
Right. It's been widely documented how we are tend in this society to avoid talking about those kinds of issues, and lots of literature has been written about that. Well, let's talk a little bit about the five wishes. Do you want to tell us what those are?
Well, actually, this is another one of those things that I would not have come across but through Final Exit. At our meeting 2 weeks ago, we discussed this document, which is made available through the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation at Princeton, New Jersey. And there is a website here as well called AgingWithDignity.org, where one can obtain this document. Basically, the document is, as the title described, an opportunity to express your wishes on five end-of-life issues. The first one being, and I'll read the first wish, the person I want to make healthcare decisions for me when I can't make them for myself. And there are here you indicate you're the person whom you want to be your agent for healthcare. By the time you filled out this first part of the document, you have completed both a living will and a power of attorney for healthcare, and it is a legally binding document that doesn't need to be notarized, at least in the state of Illinois, as I understand. So already, just this first question, I mean, who is your agent? Who do you want making these decisions for you? In my case, it's my wife. In my wife's case, it's me. But then there was the question of, okay, let's say both of us die in a fiery crash or something like that. Who is the next person? We have two daughters, and so we had the decision which daughter would be the next person if both of us were to die simultaneously. That's not an easy choice, and we had to consult both daughters, and by the time we were through discussing it with them, it was pretty obvious which daughter we should give this responsibility to. So that's just the first step, and then go on to the next four.
And by the way, was that clear in the case of your mother? Were you the individual designated, or was that left ambiguous?
That must have been left ambiguous. Mm-hmm. I live further away from her than did my sister, and my sister acted, you know, in that position. But both she and my brother, very late in the process, my mother began hemorrhaging from various sites. Mm-hmm. And the doctors wanted to do surgery, and both my sister and my brother said no. Don't do surgery, and they wheeled her down the hall and did surgery. They ignored them completely.
What year was
and
this?
That does happen even, well, that was quite several years ago, but it still happens. I hear in our group, we hear stories about it still happening.
But that, is that because they didn't have power of attorney?
Well, our attorney told us that power of attorney was more effective, actually, than a living will.
I see.
That the, in if it's something in question, the doctors will go to the living will, if there is one. And she says it's better, actually, to just have this healthcare power of attorney, which seems to be going by different names. I think Five Wishes calls that person the agent.
Yeah.
So this was vague or undetermined in your case.
Okay. Right.
I'm just thinking her case might be in a good example of why this is important.
Yeah, and the other important thing that her case, I think, brings out is that once this document is completed and witnessed by two people, then you should give copies of this to your lawyer and to your primary health care provider. And make sure that it's up to date. And the issue my wife keeps raising is that, of course, Carl, which is our healthcare provider, is going electronic on most of their record keeping, and this is a paper document. And my answer to that is you make sure that your doctor has a copy, you make sure that your agent has a copy, which in our case includes our older daughter. And then if by any chance somebody says, well, I don't see anything here electronically that says that, you know, that there's a DNR or that there's any specifications to how you want to be treated during your last hours or something like that, you have your agent there with a copy of this saying it's there somewhere in your moldy old paper files, and if you haven't got it, go get it, because here it is.
And the second wish?
Let's see.
Did we cover the territory on the first
one? Right. The second wish is my wish for the kind of medical treatment I want or don't want. And here there are some really very difficult questions to answer. This is the part I thought would be relatively easy. But in fact, if you are close to death, what kind of life support treatment do you want? Do you want life to be supported? If so, under what conditions? If not, why not? And so on. Second, permanent and severe brain damage and not expected to recover. Do you want life support to continue under those circumstances? In a coma, not expected to wake up or recover. And each of these gives you choices that you indicate your wishes for that end of life treatment.
We have a caller on line one. Hello, you're on Keeping the Faith. You have a question?
Yes, hello. My question is, do you think the Internet has made it easier or worse? And I'll hang up and listen to your answer.
Thank you very much.
Easier or worse for what?
Well, let's try to connect the dots. More information, more options for available to people to do these things, or what? Do you think you have a sense
I think
of where this?
As in so many cases, I think the internet has made many things much easier, but it contains some obvious dangers, and that is that it's possible to become misinformed by going to the wrong website where people say things and they don't know what they're talking about.
Get bad advice.
Yeah, get bad advice. And I think particularly in medical matters, this is a real danger because there's no end of people out there who want to share both their medical experience and their medical advice, which may or may not be accurate. In general, though, I think it's made, if you can zero in on groups that include people who really know what they're talking about, and documents like the Five Wishes that is, fully accepted now in 38 of the 50 states, including Illinois. So it's a legally binding document. You're on solid ground following their advice.
Mm-hmm. You were in the middle of the second wish.
Yeah, actually. I think those are most of the questions that are taken up in the second wish.
Mm-hmm.
What kinds of medical treatment do you want, life support and so on? The third question.
Hospice.
Well, the third question really gets into more hospice-related issues, my wish for how comfortable I want to be, including things like pain medication. How do you wish to be treated? Right down to things like what kinds of music. Do you want to have religious readings and well-loved poems read aloud while you are near death? Have a cool, moist cloth put on my head if I have a fever. I mean, very, very specific kinds of things, but about which you can express a preference. Or if, on the other hand, you don't wish to have the Bible or some other religious document read while you're in extremis, then you cross this out, and it is, again, a legally binding document.
The general principle being to maximize control,
yeah.
Just at the time in your life when you are losing it.
I think that's a good way to put it. In fact, one of the interesting things is I've looked at this whole process as one in which we sort of extend the control that we've tried to impose on all other aspects of our life to that part of our life over which most people historically tend to lose control. I mean, you're most impotent at that point where you're disabled and terminally ill or whatever. And
traditional clinical settings don't or haven't encouraged control for most patients.
Exactly.
And are there other ways that this wish can be fulfilled?
Let's see, we're still talking about wish number three?
Mm-hmm.
Well, the first one, and certainly one that's on the minds of anybody who's been very, very seriously ill and has thought about having a terminal illness is pain management. And, of course, hospices are wonderful at this. They've acquired a great deal of experience and expertise in relieving pain. Here you can indicate just how far you want that to go. Do you wish to stay as alert as possible, even though you may experience considerable pain? On the other hand, do you want pain medication to be used even if it makes you drowsy and non-responsive for extended periods of time? These are things that I think most people would like to answer before it comes to that.
Some of the literature highlights the fact that we don't really fully comprehend what that experience is like until we actually get there. And specifying directives ahead of time, we sometimes discover that once we're there, we wish we had changed them. Has that created difficulties? And is there a second opinion that you have a right to override once you've recorded these, particularly if you lose the ability to communicate intelligently or coherently?
That's a good question. I mean, once the advice that I've heard in the group, and which makes sense to me, is to keep it as updated as possible, precisely because there is that contingency. I mean, you never know at what point you're going to be beyond
changing your mind.
And that's where things can become difficult. It's good to have conversations about these things as frequently as possible with your agent, as they call it in this document.
And as I understand, final exit, that's why you exist, so that people can talk about these transparently and openly and rationally.
Absolutely, right. Mm-hmm. Yes.
You want to go on to your fourth wish?
Wish number four, my wish for how I want people to treat me. Do you want people around? You want someone to be with me when it seems that death may come at any time. I wish to have my hand held and to be talked to when possible, even if I don't seem to respond to the voice or touch of others. I wish to have others by my side praying for me when possible. Now, if you choose not to have that option, you cross that out. I wish to have the members of my faith community told that I'm sick and asked to pray for me. And again, the option is yours. I wish to be cared for with kindness and cheerfulness and not sadness. I wish to have pictures of loved ones in my room near my bed. I mean, these are all things that are taken into consideration as a part of this fourth wish. So,
I gather that particularly the last two are the ones that you would have most loved for your mother to have been able to express and have fulfilled, right?
Right.
Do you have any sense of what she might have wanted if she had been able to think it through, or is that too hypothetical?
I can't read her mind, especially this many years after she's sure. gone, but probably would come back to the possibility that we might change our minds.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, I had a dear friend and neighbor just last year who had been a member of Hemlock Society, that's before we started our local group, and had always said that he wanted the ability to take his own life when the time came. And he did have, you know, the various terminal illnesses. His family did supply the necessary medications and put them by his bedside with a glass of water. He changed his mind. That's okay. And I'm told that in Oregon, where people have that choice, oftentimes, sometimes they exercise it and sometimes they change their mind.
Mm-hmm.
And that's perfectly fine. That's why we emphasize that it is the individual's choice. All of it's the individual's choice.
Before we get to the fifth wish, let's talk a little bit about the Oregon law in the context of this. Not everyone is aware of what's going on in Oregon.
I'm not sure what's going on in Oregon most recently. The law has been the Oregon, I guess they call it the Death with Dignity mm-hmm. Law, has been on the books since, I think, 1998.
That's, and I recall it being challenged by the Justice Department, the Bush
That's
administration.
Right, Gonzalez versus Oregon, which was won by the state of Oregon.
Mm-hmm.
The interesting thing, I really admire the Oregon case. It is, from many standpoints, a relatively conservative law because it deals with some of the questions that Laura was just talking about. First of all, to fall within the parameters of the Death with Dignity law, you have to have been diagnosed as terminally ill with death 6 months away or less by two independent physicians.
Mm-hmm.
You must request to have your life not terminated, but physician-assisted euthanasia, basically.
Your term, or the term in the literature, final exit is self-deliverance?
Well, self-deliverance is really suicide. I think self-deliverance is a euphemism for suicide.
All right.
Physician-assisted euthanasia or suicide is simply assistance provided by a physician under certain circumstance for somebody, mm-hmm. as I say, who has been diagnosed as terminally ill within 6 months of death. And then having requested it and then having to wait 2 weeks and request it again.
Mm-hmm.
So the possibility that someone will change their mind is, of course, a possibility. The person must be demonstrably sane of mind and capable of making decisions for himself or herself. It's an extremely, I mean, from my perspective at least, I'm sure other people would disagree, but from my perspective, it's an extremely responsible piece of legislation. And from the time it was passed until, as far as I know, the present, it has received support from the people of the state of Oregon.
That's what I've heard. I've heard the latest polls, the Oregonian public supports it.
Yeah. It's been used relatively rarely. I mean, in the first 3 or 4 years, I think there were less than 200 deaths in the state. Of course, the current administration in Washington went after it and failed. And when the law was, a referendum was voted on to reaffirm the law, it got a greater support than it had initially at the time of passage, with support, I think, over 60% of the population voted for the legislation. So something that Oregonians seem to be very happy with. And it's the only state that has such a law, of course.
That's what I hear.
And so physician-assisted suicide or euthanasia is legal only in the state of Oregon.
For Oregonian citizens.
Right. And they take citizenship very seriously. They don't want people coming there to take advantage of the law. Short of that, of course, it's certainly not illegal to provide people with information, to provide them with support, to provide them with hospice care, obviously, and so on. But that's a different thing.
And just to make one point that you have indicated in your local organization, Final Exit is the local affiliate group is not interested in legal reform. That you leave that to other organizations to do. You're focused primarily on support for people struggling with end of life issues. Is that fair to say?
Right. Mm-hmm. We don't work on legislation. We do. I mean the National Network does support other organizations who work in that area.
One last chance here. This is a call-in program, and if you'd like to present a question to Bob Jones or Laurel Wetzel on the Final Exit Network and the local affiliate that's just started, you can call in 333-9455, or you can call our 800 number, 1-800-222-9455. And we have a call here on line one. Hello, you're on Keeping the Faith. Your question? Hello? I think we might have lost him. I think I might have lost you, so feel free to call in again, and we'll try to take your question.
There's something that I could maybe clarify. We tend not to use the term suicide because some people associate that with maybe a younger person taking their own life when, in fact, they had maybe just a life crisis or temporary depression or, you know, something that was treatable. Mm-hmm. So that's why we kind of steer away from that word suicide and use self-deliverance instead.
If we have time, we should come back and talk about that. We have a caller on line one. Your question.
Hi. I went to the last meeting of the group, and we had some conversations afterwards, and I got to thinking that although the Five Wishes sounds like a very useful document, I think that decisions about dying sometimes happen much sooner than when death is clearly evident going to happen in a very short time. For instance, if somebody who's very ill has developed pneumonia, do you treat it? I'm thinking that one of the conversations that society needs to have and that it would be lovely to have developed is what questions should my agent or should I be asking healthcare professionals to help to decide whether to pursue treatment or medical procedures or medications. If I'm clearly near the end of my life, but, you know, could be a couple of months, could be a couple of years. What if I have dementia, et cetera, et cetera? What kinds of questions should be asked? And it's more from the point of view of we don't, you know, know what the situation is going to be. What kind of questions would be useful? I don't know what it's like to die from pneumonia. But I do want to say that there was an interesting article in the Sunday New York Times magazine, might have been August of last year or the year before, is my guess, and it was about dying, and it was about, in part, about the fact that sometimes when we postpone death by treating something, that we end up with a more difficult death down the road, shortly down the road. So what kind of questions can we ask about that? I expect that the two guests necessarily know the answer, but I'm proposing to listeners that we maybe need to start asking these questions when we're helping a family member through this final journey of their lives. And Steve, I had given you a copy.
This is Don. Steve's not on today. Sorry.
I'm sorry.
It's all right.
I gave you a copy of a.
Steve may be listening from Israel, but I doubt it. Go ahead.
I gave Steve, I guess, the copy of "Dying a Natural Process" by Denise Cope, who's a hospice care, long-time hospice care nurse. It's just 40 pages long, but my stepsister had it sent to me because I was here where her dad was, and I was helping him through his final stages of life, and she wanted me to have it. Unfortunately, it didn't arrive until the day after he died. Fortunately, I was following my instincts and talking with her, and I knew what he wanted, and although he didn't choose self-deliverance, it would still have been helpful to know what the process of dying is like.
Well, let's turn to our guests and see what your response is. Go ahead.
Hi, Susan. I read the book. It's very helpful. I thought it made some real good points. It has been a while since I read it, and I'm afraid it's not real fresh in my mind. But I totally agree that we should be having these discussions and that we don't necessarily know what questions we should be asking.
One reason why you exist is to explore those.
Exactly. I think our group is a good place to be.
You have an agenda item for your next meeting.
Yeah.
Is Susan still on the line?
Yes. Yeah,
I'm not sure if this is the article from the New York Times Sunday magazine you were thinking of, but there was an article written by David Reif a year or two ago about his mother, who was Susan Sontag, which to me was one of the most horrific accounts of somebody dying that I've ever seen, precisely because she had no interest in quality of life. She just wanted to stay alive. I've never read anything about someone who determinedly and aggressively was willing to suffer enormous pain and be the subject of experimental drugs with serious side effects and so on, simply to live for six more months. It was so counterintuitive and unnatural from my standpoint that I read it with my eyes bugging wide open. I was it really made me think very seriously about the kinds of questions that you're asking, precisely because my approach to these things is utterly orthogonal to that. I feel just the opposite of the way she did about these things. The other thing that occurs to me in your question, and this comes up from conversations with my wife, is that we talk about a lot of these things, and we're talking about the things that we can achieve at least the semblance of control over. But the fact is that not just pneumonia, but other diseases. My wife and I were talking the other day about Alzheimer's because we'd seen this film that just came out at the Art Theater that was called Away From Her. It's about a couple where the wife develops Alzheimer's, and it's about their what happens to her and their relationship as a consequence. In the case with Alzheimer's, of course, someone has a very serious illness, which is eventually terminal, but may have this for 10 or 15 years. And a substantial part of that time may be totally unable to exercise legally verifiable decision-making, in which case everything devolves on the agent. And these, of course, fall completely outside of even the Oregon case. And we need to talk about these. ALS is another one where people can survive for an extended period of time, but really have little control over their environment. So we're in no means in a condition of being able to achieve through this document or any other the kind of control we might like to.
Have we addressed your question?
Yes. I wanted to say that I've mentioned this book once before on one of the daytime call-in shows, and apparently a couple of listeners called and asked about it. I will call in tomorrow to the WILL office and give them the contact information for this. If anybody wanted to get a copy, it's just 40 pages, and I think it was $15. It doesn't take long to read. But there's a lot of things I didn't know about dying. It's kind of, the author's point is that in learning about dying, we're like what we were 40 years ago in terms of people, the average person knowing about childbirth. And we help people come into the world. How can we make the last stages of someone's life more comfortable if we know, and can we do that and be less fearful if we know what's going on? So that's her point, and I'll leave that information tomorrow with WILL.
Well, thank you very much. If anyone is interested in finding out more about the local affiliate group, you can also call WILL tomorrow, and they will pass it on to the organization and make a contact. We have two other callers here. Line two, hello. You're on Keeping the Faith. Your question.
Hello, I called in earlier. I wanted to know, I've been a worker in hospice for over 40 years, and so the thing for me was to talk about the quality and the quantity of life. And I have kids, three boys, for example. So I wonder, they call today, I know those are the questions that I have. The quality and quantity of life.
Thank you very much. Jen?
Yes.
I'm sorry.
Laura. That seems like, and I guess...
Open-ended.
Yeah, open-ended question. And it's those are the decisions that the individuals have to make themselves. And they're difficult to make, very, very difficult. I want to, for my five wishes, I want to be very specific, and yet I don't know exactly how to do that.
Mm-hmm. Well, we haven't gotten to the fifth wish yet, but we do have one more caller here. Before we go, line two, did you have another question?
No, that's it. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Line three, hello, you're on Keeping the Faith.
I'm hearing you, and I'm truly surprised at how few people in our modern-ish social system has never seen a birth or death or experienced much of either. The thought that I have is because suicide is defined as a legal crime, I believe. What is and it's touted in many religious organizations as being a will of God, and I suspect it might be a will of the people that are running the religious organization. Where are the written prohibitions against deciding that, hey, I've had enough, and I'll listen on radio?
Thank you very much. Bye.
I'm not a lawyer, but I have read Derek Humphrey's book, and if it's accurate, in most states, if not all states, it is not, in fact, illegal to take your own life. And it is not even illegal to be present when someone else takes their life. What is illegal is to assist anyone else in taking their own life. And that is the sort of line that cannot be crossed unless you're in Oregon or you're a physician. So what we're really discussing here is very largely along the lines of providing people with information, which is legal, providing them with support, which is certainly legal. Even in Derek Humphrey's book, when he talks about counseling someone who has decided...
The title of the book?
Final Exit.
Right.
Even in the Final Exit book, he says when you're counseling somebody, when you're speaking with somebody who has decided to take their own life, it is best to proceed by gently dissuading them. Not because you think that they have no right to take their own life, but rather because it is good for them to review the reasons in their own minds before they proceed to take what is an irrevocable step. But that's my understanding. Again, I'm not a lawyer, but that's my understanding of the legal context of these decisions. And I agree completely with what you say about modern life. Birth, death, all of the significant things are considerably disguised from us. I agree.
Why don't we move on to our fifth principle, or our fifth wish, I'm sorry.
Actually, the fifth wish to me was one of the most interesting, because this is a wish for what I want my loved ones to know, including what I want them to know after I'm gone. Actually, this inspired the largest and most active conversations I had with my wife about this, because there are a number of these that you may feel one way or the other about. I mean, where there's some backward and forward thinking about these things. I wish to have my family and friends know that I love them. Well, that's fairly straightforward. I wish to be forgiven for the times I have hurt my family, friends, and others. And the one that follows it immediately, I wish to have my family, friends, and others know that I forgive them for when they may have hurt me in my life. One of the interesting things, of course, about death, and one of the most horrible things about it, is that it brings out, in many cases, the absolute worst in families. Children squabbling with one another or with their parents over issues that you thought were dead for 25 years. And it's important, I think, for the person who is approaching the end of his or her life to be able to indicate how they would like to be remembered, what they would like their family members and their friends to think of them, and that in itself carries some peace of mind, I assume.
In the Jewish tradition, there's something called the ethical will that has been discussed more widely. Have you discussed that?
No.
Sounds like something we should discuss.
It's a very interesting approach where you write down as much that you have learned, your wisdom, the values you'd like to impart, principles you'd like to pass on.
It's a very similar thing.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Except it goes a little bit further. You have to be fairly reflective, or have been reflective, about your life and your approach to living and dying in order to articulate that, and sometimes you need help with someone else, but it strikes me as a good way to go.
One of the questions here, just very briefly, if anyone asks how I want to be remembered, please say the following about me, and then you have several lines.
There you go.
Do exactly
what you're talking about. Has a similar one.
Yeah.
Well, we're winding down here, and as I understand it, on July 8th, you have an event coming up. You want to describe that?
That's right. The president of the Illinois affiliate, who lives in the Chicago area, will be here. Her name is Rosalie Gutman, and she will address our group. We meet at the Windsor of Savoy at 2 p.m. Now, the Windsor does not sponsor us. They simply provide a place for us to meet. And I also wanted to say that I've been amazed how quickly this group has taken off. We started in January with just eight people, and already without much publicity at all, we've gone to 30 people and more.
Thank you both for being with us, Laura Wetzel and Bob Jones from the local affiliate of Final Exit. This is Keeping the Faith. Thank you for being with us.
Thanks, Tom.
You've been listening to Keepin' the Faith, the production of WILL AM 580. The opinions expressed on this program are solely those of the participants.
As the end of our fundraising year approaches, we still must raise around $278,000 to meet our goal. That means our gas gauge now reads 87% full. Help power the engine so WILL can bring you a full year of programs and services. Call 217-244-9455 with a contribution today. Thank you. Tonight in Champaign-Urbana, mostly cloudy with a chance of showers and thunderstorms. Patchy fog overnight. The low in the mid-60s with light southeast winds. Tomorrow, partly sunny with a high in the mid-80s and south winds 5 to 10 miles per hour. Tomorrow night, partly cloudy with the low in the upper 60s and south winds 5 to 10 miles per hour.